The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, Upgrade listeners. Since it's the Monday after Thanksgiving, chances are you need a drink.
And because you need a drink, we are recasting our episode, How to Have Good Taste in Wine, with Marissa Ross.
Come on, you just spent a long weekend with people who push all your buttons.
You need some wine.
And welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at lifehacker.com, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
Today we're talking about wine, how to choose it, buy it, order it, drink it, talk about it, and stop feeling intimidated by it. And yes, in addition to talking about wine, we'll also be tasting some wines.
We'll be trying three different wines with our guest Marissa Ross. Marissa is the official wine columnist for Bon Appetit, and her column Unfiltered appears monthly in the print magazine.
Her blog Wine All the Time earned her Editors and Readers' Choice Awards at the Sever Blog Awards. Her new book, also called Wine All the Time, The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking, came out last week. So Alice, I have tried to learn about wine several times.
Mm-hmm.
Once upon a time, I was in a wine club, wherein five friends and I got together once a month and tried a different varietal of wine. I had a book called The Wine Club that I was following. Each month, a different person would host at their house and would cook foods to accompany the wines. We each brought one bottle of that particular varietal, and then we would cover the bottles with tinfoil so we couldn't see what they were, and then taste them and talk about them and get drunk and eat and learn about wine.
Huh.
And I remember absolutely nothing of the 2.5 years I spent drinking wine and studying it every month.
That makes me feel a little bit better because I've been to a few wine tastings and also have just let the information fall from my brain the moment I left that place.
Why do you think it's so hard to remember how to drink wine or how to have good taste in wine?
I think it's just the sheer variety of wines. There's just so many. You can't be expected to know every kind, right?
You know, I think the issue that I have with wine is I'm not going to drink wine if I'm going to get drunk because I don't like it enough. It's a lot to drink. It seems not delicious and not thirst quenching. So if I am drinking for the effect of alcohol, I'm going to have a cocktail. I'm not going to drink beer, but that's for another episode. I don't like beer at all. So with wine, it's supposed to be this experience, right? Like you're sampling a wine, you're tasting it in the appropriate fashion. You have a whole vocabulary that goes along with it. There are, you know, different price points and vintages and terroirs and all these things to remember. And really, I just want to have a drink with dinner. You know what I mean?
Totally.
And it seems difficult. It seems challenging. I would like to be a person who understands wine, but I feel like it hasn't stayed with me because it doesn't seem that important to me.
Yeah, but maybe that's it. Maybe you're just not a huge wine fan. It's also, yeah, it's not only the different kinds of varietals and the terroir and all of those various things, but also how it relates to the food you're about to eat. So it's not like you can just order wine because you like that kind of wine. It also depends on how it interacts with the food. And it feels like a test that I'm never going to pass.
But you drink wine, right?
I do drink wine. I like wine. But I feel the same way. I feel kind of overwhelmed with it. And I just kind of, what I do is I just go and buy the kind of wine I know I like and then kind of drink it, not in secrecy, but in my home where no one will judge me for.
What kind of wine do you like?
I really like Vino Verde. That's like my favorite kind of wine. It's like light and slightly bubbly, but not super bubbly. And it's really dry. And it feels like coming home from work and everything's going to be okay.
I'm sorry that you feel when you come home from work, you need something to convince you everything's going to be okay.
God help me. The day I've had with Melissa, I got to have some Vino Verde to erase it.
Okay.
And I just keep drinking until memories fade.
That's beautiful. I'm glad I can be the inspiration.
You've taught me to love wine.
Today, we're talking to Marissa Ross about her new book, Wine All the Time. Hey, Marissa.
Hey, Marissa.
Hello, how's it going?
How did you first get into wine? What brought you from just liking wine to wanting to write about it?
So from growing up in California in the 90s, I was around a lot of wine. And slowly but surely, I started drinking it while I was writing my comedy stuff. And I just really enjoyed having a glass of wine and writing. And then eventually, I realized that all wines under $10 kind of tasted like all other wines under $10. So I started branching out. And when I did that, I realized that there was just this like whole other world of wine. And what got me into writing about it in a more, I guess not serious way, but writing about it specifically was I just felt like every bottle was so different and each of them had a story. And whether that story was the story that the winemaker was specifically trying to tell, or it was the story that the wine was just telling me, like on its own and where it was taking me. I just love that. And as a writer, it sort of gave me a new medium in order to express myself. And I just ran with it.
How did you go from Two Buck Chuck to wine connoisseur, though? So you started exploring and realizing that you had the palate for it?
I definitely didn't have the palate when I started for it. I think that a lot of people, I think of palates as like anything else where you have to develop it. You know, you just really don't. You don't know the difference between $2 wine and $50 wine unless you're, like, having them. And also, too, a $50 wine doesn't necessarily make it a good wine. But how it sort of happened was I started with this really cheap wine because I was so broke when I moved to Los Angeles. And like I said, I was reviewing these wines under $10 for actually a web series I did called Wine Time.
Hello, and welcome to Wine Time, the show where a woman who has absolutely no qualifications to be reviewing wine, aside from the fact that she drinks it every day, reviews wine. I'm your woman, Marissa A. Ross. Today we are joined by a very special guest, my very good friend, Miss Mindy Kaling.
Very special guest.
Very special.
And then I started going to wine tastings where you can actually sort of, you know, taste things side by side and actually start comparing and contrasting wines. And that's when I became like sort of obsessive about it. And it also helped me develop my palate because a lot of your palate, people don't realize, is just your brain. You know, and being able to differentiate between different things. But you have to have the experience of a lot of different wines in order to do that. How do you know what oak tastes like if you've only been drinking these wines that are oaked? You know, because in your mind, you'll just be like, well, that's what wine tastes like, and not be able to like pick out the particular flavor of oak. But then when you start drinking like unoaked wines, you're like, oh, it's not that all wine tastes this way. It's that particular fermentation tastes that way. And I started researching those things, and from there, it just spiraled.
Wine seems like something that has traditionally been the province of the wealthy or the people with refined tastes. Why is that?
I personally believe that wine is always on a pendulum that swings between wine being for the people and wine being for status. And if you think about the last 25 years, let's say, wine really hit peak for status like in the 90s. You know, we had all those big California wines that were very much collectible and, you know, a lot of auctioning going on and all the Bordeaux of the 70s and things like that. And that was really, I think, kind of when wine snobbery, at least in my lifetime, you know, like I even remember as a child, like realizing that wine was like a very snobby, stuffy sort of thing. But that pendulum, since it hit peak status, I believe that pendulum has been swinging back for the people, you know, and now we are able to let go of that baggage, hopefully. But it's hard because most of us that are drinking wine today, our relationship with wine does have that baggage. That's how we think about wine. That's how wine has been treated in front of us. That's how the wine culture has shown it to us. And it's going to be changing more, not to put like myself like on a pedestal, but like the fact that I get to write this book and I write for Bon Appetit and I write about it in this more accessible way, that's allowing people that perhaps wouldn't have drank wine or would be too scared to drink wine and nervous about it to be able to and feel good about it. And if we keep promoting this idea that wine is for everyone and everyone can drink it, then I think that baggage will fall until the pendulum starts swinging back and we're all fucked again.
I have a question. Why do people like red wine? No, I understand.
I have a question. Why don't you like red wine?
Because I don't like room temperature drinks.
Well, most people serve their reds too warm.
Really?
Yes. The reds should be served at cellar temperature, which is 54 degrees.
Oh. This could be a game changer for
you.
Yeah,
I chill most of my reds in the refrigerator. A big red wine, you would want to serve it at 54 degrees and let it warm up to room, which actually I think is a lot better. But a lighter bodied style red wine, like a Gamay or a Sumol or things like that, I put them in the actual refrigerator for like 20 minutes before I drink them out of my wine fridge. Like even though it's already starting at 54, like I'll put it in my fridge after. So I think that maybe that might change things for you. Or it might be that you haven't found the right red wine because I used to hate white wine. Like I used to hate it. And now I don't, and I enjoy white wine all the time. So I think it's like about trying as many new things as possible. And that's why going to tastings is such a great way to learn about wine, because then you're not throwing your money at a whole bottle, you know, like especially if you don't really like red wines. But if you start going to tastings, then you can just have a sip of a red wine and be like, huh, okay, that's something more that I would like to drink versus that's not something I would like to drink.
It took me a long time to admit that I don't like red wine, and my life has gotten a lot better since I started saying, like, no, thank you, I don't like red wine. I was a caterer one summer, and the two choices for the guests at parties would be red or white.
Yeah.
And the head of the catering company came up and said, I'll have a glass of wine to me, and I said, red or white. And he gave me this stern look, and he said, Melissa, grown-ups drink red wine.
Whoa, that's mean and wrong.
And that stayed with me. So I've been trying to be a grown-up and trying to like red wine and finding that it doesn't agree with me.
Yeah. I mean, you might just not like red wine, and that's okay. And I would never want to pressure anyone to be like, you have to like something, because that's what shitty wine people do. But I will say that as someone that genuinely fucking hated white wine. Like, I mean, there's like videos of me on the internet somewhere being like, I will never be seen publicly drinking white wine. I hate white wine. And now, you know, there's a lot of white wines I love. And it might very well be the style of it, because most people are serving these big, huge, jammy red wines. Like I think the one that we have right here, you're probably not going to like. But there's so many different styles of wine that to write off like a whole category of them, I think is a bit limiting to your enjoyment eventually. But also too, like if you don't like red wine, you don't like red wine. Like I don't really like Moscato. That's my thing. Like I'm not a Moscato drinker. I've found one that I like. I've always continued to try them because I have to for my job. But I don't like them, and that's okay.
Is that a dessert wine?
It can be.
Yeah, it's sweet, right?
It's on the sweet side, and I'm not into sweet stuff. Like, yeah. I'm not a sweet person.
What didn't you like about white wine, and what white wines do you like?
So I didn't like white wine because I thought all of them were oaky. I thought all of them tasted like oak, and I just thought they were gross. And I realized over time, it's not that I don't like white wine. It's I don't like oak, I don't like over-oaked wines.
Tell us what that means.
When a wine is fermented in oak, it creates this very toasty, nutty, and in Chardonnay, very buttery taste, right? I thought that that's just what white wine tasted like. I didn't realize that that was a winemaker's choice. And when I say over-oaking, I mean that in the 90s, high oak and like Chardonnays and stuff became very trendy. And they began to add like oak flavoring kind of to these wines to make them even oakier than maybe they would, or you know, so they have ways of making them taste even oakier because that's the trend and the style of those wines. And once I got out of that habit and started trying other white wines, I realized I loved white wines that were fermented in steel, where it really let the grape itself and the terroir of the region shine more. And so you got a lot more fruit and a lot more, you know, earthy notes in white wines rather than this just big oak bomb, you know, which I just think is extremely overpowering flavor. I prefer wines that you can actually taste more of the land and the grapes. And so once I started, you know, drinking and experimenting with those, I found that there was lots of them I love. Like I love Vino Verde is one of my favorites.
Yeah, me too. It's
such a beautiful, like nice, light, mineral, slightly sparkling, delicious wine. Grüner Veltliner, another very high mineral, a little bit more herbal white wine. No oak on that, you know. And so once you're finding the things that fit your palate and kind of can discern, then you realize, oh, it's not about hating all of this. It's about realizing I don't like that, but this is good. Or, you know, or you have to just try. Like, and that's hard and it's scary. So I totally get it.
You mentioned the word terroir.
Yes, terroir.
For the uneducated among us.
Yeah, no. So, and it's actually a really, really important word. Terroir is the entire ecosystem of a vineyard. So it's the vines, it's the crops, like the crop cover that grows around the vines, like the vegetation. It's the, the climate. It's everything, like just about the land. I mean, there's definitely a disagreement on how much terroir really affects wine. I personally believe that it affects a wine very much. Like what is in the soil, what the soil is made of. I think that's very important because I think of like a sandy vineyard, you know, which sounds weird, but there's like definitely like sandy vineyards. You can taste that in a wine. Or like the limestone, like in the Loire, you can really taste that in the wines, I personally believe. So that's what terroir is. It's really letting the grapes and the land that they are grown on shine in the wine.
Mm-hmm. So when you go to a wine shop, how do you know these things about the wines? Do the people working there?
It's a scary thing, but I try to, one, I'm glad you said wine shop because that's what's important. You got to go to a wine shop. That's the first thing because it's so important to start being okay with asking questions. I think it's really important to develop a relationship with a local wine shop so you can ask about these things. So you can say, hey, you know what? I really don't like these types of red wines. Is there a red wine for a white wine drinker that you would recommend? Is there something and I recommend Gamay. You can give it a shot, put it in the fridge. It's really good. That's my favorite red wine. So you start these conversations and you learn a lot that way, you know, and you're learning from the person in the wine shop that's trying those wines, that has extensive knowledge about them. And it helps you guide you on this like wine journey that you're having to find what you love. And then eventually you kind of get a sense of things and then you feel more confident doing it yourself. And I always ask what's new of the wine shop. That's like my big thing. Like what's new, what's fresh? Like I treat it like food. Like what's here? Like what should I be drinking right now? And for me, that means it's not only new to the shop and it's freshest on the staff's mind because they probably taste it really recently, but it's also really new to me. I probably haven't had it. And that's always something fun. And always talk about your budget when you go into a wine shop. Don't be afraid of doing that. A lot of people are weirded out about that, but you got to do it. And, you know, because there's great wines in all price points. And also, once you figure out the things that you do like, moving from there, like being like, oh, I like Pinot Noir. What's like that? Or, oh, I like Chardonnay. What's like that but different? And expanding your palate that way.
If I want to go over to the shelf and pick out a wine without talking to anybody, which is inadvisable according to your instructions.
Yeah.
But if I'm that kind of person and I just want to have a completely solo journey through the wine shop, are there any sort of tricks or is there anything I should remember when looking at prices of wines or types of wines or if I sort of want something that's not going to be too anything? Any advice?
You have to read the labels. You have to like actually read them. So most people will be like, oh, this looks cool. Let's do it, you know, and be out there, right? Or they'll look at the price and be like, okay, like I'll do this. I think you have to just read everything on there because you can pick up a ton of clues about what a wine is like by reading it. Not only do some of them have descriptions on them, like for example, one we have here. This one says, this fresh Martin Chardonnay comes from the warm Central Valley where the grapes achieve their perfect ripeness. Its aromas are reminiscent of pears and pineapples, while on the palate, flavors of vanilla, butter, and subtle oak nuances are to be found. Best served chilled. This, you know, like if you read that, you're like, okay, now I know what the wine is kind of like. But a lot of wines don't have that. A good tip is to look at the alcohol by volume, the percentage. The higher the alcohol by volume, the riper and bolder the wine is going to be. Hmm. And also climates. So there's warm climate wines and cool climate wines, which affect the alcohol by volume content because in warmer climates, the grapes ripen. They just get a lot riper. So they produce more sugar and they can be bolder, bigger, and then they have a higher alcohol content. So you know that you're getting something that's full-bodied, really like kind of more of a dinner wine, you know, like especially like if you're talking like the more recent Zinfandels that were like 15, 16%, like that's crazy. But then you're like, holy shit, that's got 15% alcohol. I don't need that. That's like a really big, big, bold wine. Whereas like cooler climate wines, because they're colder, the grapes have more acidity in them. So you're going to get wines that have a lower alcohol by volume percentage and like maybe the anywhere between like 10 and 13% alcohol. And those are going to be on the lighter side with more acidity. And so that's, I think that those are always helpful things because if you can know nothing about the varietal, but you can look at the alcohol by volume and be like, all right, that's going to be to this or to that and move on from there.
That has never occurred to me to look at alcohol by volume.
I know. No, people don't think about it.
Just always assumed it was all the kind of the same. It's like wine is, you know, gets you a certain amount of drunk. I don't know.
Yeah. No. I think it's like a really helpful tip with that because the alcohol by volume has to be on the label by law.
Mm-hmm.
So while a winery doesn't have to tell you really anything, they could just slap a sticker on it and, you know, whatever. It does have to say alcohol by volume.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use that as like a good little guide without knowing or asking any questions.
Yeah.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So what about price? Does it really matter? Like you can buy the $2 bottle of Chuck or you can buy the $10 bottle or you can buy the $100 bottle. At what point does the price not matter so much?
Right. Is there a point where it's just like diminishing returns?
It really depends. I think that it is a total myth that the more money you spend, the better wine you're going to get. There are a couple $100 bottles of wine that I just think are trash. Like, it's, you know, like they're marketing or it's this or, you know, they're working off their name. Like, who knows? So there are expensive wines that suck. But then there's also very expensive wines that are amazing, like a vintage champagne, for example, like from a really like well-known house, like that can be a couple $100s or more than that. I mean, like I know people that spend like thousands of dollars on champagne. And so it really varies. For me personally, I think the good, like the sweet spot for an average, and this is hard too, because I know I'm asking a lot here. I'm asking people that are probably spending $5 on a bottle of wine to sort of make this jump. But I think the sweet spot for wine personally is in the $15 to like $40 range. The wines that I personally buy mostly and I personally drink and I write about are almost always under $40. And that's still, you know, and those are wines that I like am proud of and that are like sometimes very rare and collectible. And, you know, because especially in the natural wine world, a really beautiful wine can be $28, but there's only like, you know, 2,000 cases of it, and then you have it, and you're like, oh my God, this is so special and amazing. And it's no longer about the price as much as it is about the quality. And I think it's more important for people to focus on finding wines that they love that are made well versus like attaching quality to price. I just don't think that that's, I think that that's unfortunately a leftover from a part of the baggage from wine culture over the last 25 years.
Should we be looking out for organic wines?
Yes, most definitely. I'm a big proponent of like natural wines. I think that they're really important to the cultural climate of the world today. Like we need to be making sure that we're treating wine more like an agricultural product. Most people think about, we have like a very strange relationship as Americans with alcohol, where we're set into the wild at like 21 and we're just like binge drinking and alcohol becomes a means to an end. Whereas wine, you know, it's an agricultural product. So if you care about your kale, you kind of have to care about your wine because the same reasons that you're going to the farmer's market, let's say, to go buy like your organic kale, those same processes that you look down upon in a grocery store are the same processes that are being used on the grapes. So organic wines are great. And then, you know, you got like biodynamic wines and natural wines, and there's all sorts of different levels of stuff there. Those are great. And that's the other good thing about shopping at a wine shop is you can go in and be like, hey, I'm looking for natural wines. I'm looking for organic wines. I'm looking for biodynamic wines. And they can point you in the right direction because a lot of times they don't stay on the label. So you just don't really know.
What's the difference between natural, organic, and biodynamic?
So organic is a certified government-regulated term. You know, it's the same as with food. So there's no herbicides, no pesticides, no chemicals added. And so, yeah, just organic, like we're used to with food. Biodynamics. I'm sorry, I laughed. Biodynamics is it's like organics on like steroids, because it's all about like, basically, it's a philosophy by the philosopher Rudolf Steiner, who was like, yo, we got to make the ecosystem complete in the vineyards or wherever you're farming. Whatever you're taking out of the ground, you got to put back. Not only that, we should do it in a spiritual way, because we should be spiritually connected to the land. So it sounds a little pagan-y. Because
Rudolf Steiner, yeah, of the Waldorf,
yeah,
schools?
Yeah, I was going to say, what did he not get his hands into?
Yeah. He's like, hey, you got to take a goat's horn and stuff it with manure and plant it in the vineyard, like under the moon. Like, I don't think that's quite right, but that's one of the things you have to do. Or like, there's certain compost you have to use and spray it with a certain valerian root. And like, so it's like these very 9 specific steps, and that's regulated by its own kind of thing. But that's not really government regulated. It's more of just like their thing. But you can't. I don't think you can put it on your, you can't put it on your label unless you are, it's like very strict. Like they make sure that you can't just like say it. So biodynamic is something that you could also look out for on a label. But sometimes people don't put it. Sometimes they don't want to advertise it. Sometimes they just do it. And natural is the most ambiguous. It's an unregulated term. And in the wine community, if you say a wine is a natural wine, it means that there's nothing added in the vineyard. So no pesticides, no herbicides, no chemical fertilizers, nothing, and no irrigation. They do dry farming, which means a wine, or the land is relying solely on the natural rainfall of the region, and it means there's nothing added or taken away in the cellar. So no additives, no fining, no filtering, nothing. Occasionally, they will add some sulfites, which I think that's a whole other conversation, but you don't have to really worry about sulfites. It's not a big deal.
Is it not a big deal? Because people say that sulfites give them headaches.
I did a pretty big, like an extensive like research on this for Bon Appetit last year. And I went through the medical journals and all that. Right now, the estimated population of people that have sulfite allergies in the States is 1%. And those are generally people with asthma. So yes, there are people that are allergic to sulfites, but it is way blown out of proportion, because there's more sulfites in like a can of soda or French fries, or even like a bag of dried fruit than there is in most wines, even commercial wines. And I think that they're just kind of a cop-out, because they're on the label. And that's like a whole other story about the alcohol lobbyists, like just in the 80s trying to fuck everybody up. And they're like, nah, we got to put the contained sulfites. So everyone thinks that that's what it is, because they assume that if it's on the label, that must be bad for you, right? They're not bad for you. Like, they're naturally occurring during fermentation, and they actually preserve the wine. You need it. They're not going to hurt you. They're pretty much fine. Mm-hmm. The things that people probably blame on sulfites are, one, they're drinking too much, or two, it might be a lot of the other preservatives and chemicals that are in a wine that a wine label doesn't have to list. There's dozens of them. So you don't really know what you're drinking. You could be sensitive to any number of things that are in these wines and you wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. And then everyone's like, sulfites are the devil. They're not.
What about wine glasses? Do you need to have a different kind of glass for every kind of wine?
I don't believe so. I have a standard glass in my home that I serve everything out of. Most wine shops that I know, like in tastings and everything, kind of have a universal glass. The ones that I generally use are from Crate and Barrel, just a standard, you know, glass. You want the bowl to be a little bit wider than the rim, and that's about it. Although I just did this article where, have you heard about these glasses, these Zalto glasses?
No.
Oh my God. Okay, so they're $60 a pop. And everyone like raves about them. And I'm sorry, like I'm not buying $60 wine glasses. That's crazy. But I recently got married and I was gifted a set of them. And they're so thin and they're so beautiful. And you're just like, oh my God, I feel like they're gonna break, but they feel sturdy. Like, how is this real? Like, I don't understand this. And I tested them against every single wine glass in my house. And the wine smelled and tastes better out of the Zalto, hands down. And I tried it with like white wine, red wine, like rosé, different temperatures, different alcohol contents, like all sorts of things with about 10 different glasses of wine. Hmm. All of them tasted better out of this glass.
And are they shaped in some unique way?
They are shaped. Their thing is like they do it to the degrees that the earth is tilted, which I was like, dude, what? I don't collect crystals. I don't believe in this. Like, this is ridiculous. And I can't tell you how frustrated I was when I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that the wine was actually better. Not only that, I then would take the wines out of the other glasses, being like, all right, well, maybe this glass I just didn't clean out very well. Like, maybe there's a little soap in it. Maybe, you know, who knows what happened? Who knows? Maybe my husband put it on the dishwasher on accident. I don't know. I put the wine back in the Zalto. It still tasted better out of the Zalto.
Wow.
It was, oh my God, it drove me bananas.
But is the average wine drinker going to notice that?
Maybe. I don't know. I let all my friends know. I got an interview at my house the other day for this magazine, and he was like, I just read this thing you did. Can I see? And he was like, I don't know anything about wine. And he could tell the difference too. But they're $60. So it's like, what are you going to, like, the average consumer does not need a $60 wine glass. Like, that's craziness.
What about stemless wine glasses?
I'm against stemless wine glasses, personally, because they warm up your wine with your hands. So especially if you are drinking white wine, or if you don't like reds that are too hot, you know, if you have your palm around it, it just warms it up. And, or like, depending on where you have it, you know, sitting down, or it could be like next to the stove or whatever, like while you're cooking. So I think that I always use stemware versus stemless.
And is there any other kind of gear that we need to sort of get started with wine?
Just a double hinged wine key. And those are like $9 on Amazon. I like the pull tap ones. They're way better than the corkscrew ones with the
angel wings.
Arms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that you call them angel wings. I'm like, ugh, like flopping around like a sad penguin over here. Yeah, the double hinged ones, they're great because they have like a little elbow on them. So you get a lot more leverage. It's easier to pull the cork out, a lot less breakage. Mm-hmm. Good stuff. But that's all you need. And maybe some stoppers. That's always a good thing so that your wine stays fresher longer in case you lose your cork or, like, for example, like this one kind of has expanded. You know, it's going to be hard to get back in there.
Yeah.
You get some stoppers so that way, you know, if you don't finish a bottle.
So many wines have screw tops now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason for that? I heard something about there being a cork shortage.
Yeah, there's a cork shortage. I think that the stigma of screw tops is unfounded, really. There's beautiful wines that have screw tops. I don't think that you should be worried about the quality of the wine based on that. Me personally, I still love corks just because of the ritualistic, like pulling it out and like hearing that sound. That to me is like a creative, like, writer of wine. Like, I love that. Like, that's just like a part of it. But I also have to, you know, I'm for the environment, so I understand that we might not have cork forever. So enjoy it while you can, people.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So we brought some wines for you to taste with us. We brought a Chardonnay, a Malbec Rosé, and then a mystery red over there.
Yes, yeah, it's from
Douro.
It's a red blend from Portugal. So I'm guessing it's going to have some Tempranillo in it. I guess we'll find out. But we should probably start with the Chardonnay.
Okay, ooh. We're drinking out of classy plastic cups.
Solo cups,
as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Let's talk about an unfortunate thing that people say, which is it's wine o'clock.
Oh. Yeah, what do we do about those people? Should they be destroyed?
Listen, I want people to enjoy wine however they want, but that shit is the bane of my existence because it creates like, because it's, this sounds shitty, but it creates this weird sexism around wine because it's like women that do it and it's like they have like glitter wine glasses that are twice the size of their face and then it's like, it's mommy's juice cup. And they, and it creates this like, it creates this thing that like wine is for like, you know, bratty girls kind of, and I don't like that. I'm like, hey, wine's for everyone. So hey, if you want a glittery mommy's juice cup wine glass, that is totally up to you. If you want to say wine o'clock, that's fine, but you know,
I'm not sure what percentage of our audience are wine o'clock sayers.
I was going to say,
if you're willing to come out and say it, I was like, is this a loaded question? Are you a wine o'clock person? I was like, I don't think you guys are wine o'clock people.
Under this, I've got a t-shirt that just says, it's 1 o'clock somewhere.
My other sippy cup is a Zoltec glass.
Or like one of those like, oh my God, all those like little housewife, like silly notepads. It's like, I drink my dinner or like whatever. And you're like, no, like, let's not promote weird alcoholism. Like,
yeah. All right, should we get started?
Let's do it. Yeah. So we're going to, let's wait before we swirl into it. Let's look at this. This is
we're looking?
So we're holding up our glasses to the light.
Yeah, let's look it up.
We've got a Chardonnay.
We've got Chardonnay from Chile.
An inch and a half.
I'm very interested to try this. Yeah. And it actually is extremely light colored for a Chardonnay. I mean, that supposedly has some oak in it, according to the label.
Call this like a straw color.
Yeah.
I'd call it a straw color. I'd call it like an adequately hydrated human being's urine.
I didn't want to say that, but that's what I was thinking of.
I mean, not really light blonde hair, like in the sun, you know, like maybe like Rapunzel's hair.
Okay, so we swirl it around.
Swirl it around. Swirling's important.
Why is swirling important?
Swirling is important because it releases the esters in the wine, which is what creates the aromas. And it's really important to smell your wine. A lot of people like skip this part, the swirling and sniffing. But the way that I describe it is like if you skip swirling and sniffing, it's like you're skipping foreplay and just like banging a stranger in a bathroom. Like you're not getting to know it. You're not taking any time to like, you know, work up to something. You're just like going for it. And you want to give the wine a little bit of time to get comfortable with you, and you can get comfortable with it, and you know. So now we smell it.
So we're seducing our wine, basically.
Yeah. What are you guys getting? There's no wrong answers in wine.
It smells like a wine to me.
It smells very winey.
It smells winey.
Yeah. So this is a commercial wine that has been obviously chemically produced to smell like this.
Hmm.
It smells like wine, right?
So that's what you said. That's why we're smelling wine, or not smelling notes of anything.
Right, you're not. No, it smells like white wine.
Yeah.
What's the alcohol content?
The alcohol content on this is 13.5.
Is that low, high?
That's on the high end for a white wine, for sure. Although not from, you know, not from Chile, where it's pretty, well, I guess it depends on where in Chile it's from, but because Chile has multiple climates. So. But the reason you're not smelling anything in this is because this is a highly commercial wine.
Okay.
This has been chemically produced to smell and taste like wine. So. And that's why on the back of the label, it tells you what you're supposed to be tasting and smelling is because it doesn't actually smell or taste like that. Like, now we can taste it. Okay. So you see how there's only one flavor, though?
This, to me, tastes very drinkable. And by drinkable, I mean it doesn't make me want to spit it out.
That's fine.
But aren't you supposed to, like, swish it around your mouth and, like,
you can do that.
Chew it?
I'm all about chewing wine. I'm not going to chew this wine. Actually, no. Let's chew this wine. Show us how
to chew a wine.
You just chew it.
She's going to chew it. All right. Just, like, actually, like you're chewing.
Oh.
Wait. Describe chewing wine and what chewing is and what you do.
I wish you guys could see my face right now. When you chew a wine, you just chew it like food. You just straight up chew it. And the reason you do that is because it pushes pushes the wine to all these different corners of your mouth, and so you get a fuller appreciation of the taste. Like, you get more of it. And when you chew it, when you chew a good wine, it really changes, it has a tendency to really change the flavor. So when you're picking out notes in the wine, you will pick up things that maybe you didn't. For example, last night we were drinking a red wine that was on the lighter side, but when you chewed it, you realized that there was a lot of, like, tannin in it, which... Tannin is that dry, astringent feeling that a red wine will give you. It's like, you're like, whoa, like who, like, why does it taste like, you know, like Noxzema was in my mouth? Like, this is weird. And that's caused by stems and seeds and leaves of grapes when they're fermenting it. And since white wines are not fermented with their skins and all that stuff, they generally don't have tannins while a red wine will. Taste it again, though. Sip it again. See how there's just like one flat flavor that's from the tip of your tongue to the back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not a good sign. A good wine will have different sensations in different parts of your mouth. Whereas like this, it feels the exact same across your entire tongue.
Should we move on to the
rosé? Yeah, let's try this rosé.
We're using the same cups?
We can use new cups
right here.
Well, we can use the same ones.
We can?
Yeah, that's like...
That feels like sacrilege.
No, it's not. That's not true.
So this is a Malbec rosé from...
Argentina. Okay. And the alcohol content is, let's see, 13%, which is pretty, that's pretty high for a rosé.
So just glancing at this from the label, do you have more hope for this one?
I try to be open about everything. Wait until I taste it. We don't know. Okay. You know, so that's not fair. So but, you know, it's a really
We hold this one up to the light.
Yeah. Hold it up to the light. It has a really pretty peach quartz color to it. It looks really light. I like it. It kind of looks like it's more of like a Provençal sort of style, even though Malbec's a pretty big grape, especially from Argentina, because Argentina is really hot, and especially Mendoza. Swirl in it. Sniff it. Lots of strawberries.
I can smell strawberries.
I was actually going to say cherries. I was thought I was
definitely
cherries.
Berries.
Big berries.
Definitely yeah. Berry.
All right, let's try it. See, this one's a little bit better, in my opinion.
It's smooth.
It is smooth.
It's smoother.
Do you see the difference, Melissa?
It tastes better than the other one.
It tastes better than the other one. Also, too, this one, if you drink it, when you drink it, it's softer on the front and has more acid on the back. So there's actually like a variation of texture there, which is good.
Yeah.
That means that there's a little bit more, maybe some thought and care put into it.
Are we going to chew it now? Are we chewing it?
We're chewing. But see, even there, like, there's a lot of acid, but you're still getting notes of red berries. Yeah, it's really acidic. Not so, it's highly alcoholic. Yeah, not so good.
Okay, that really opened up into a vinegar situation.
Right? But that's...
Chewing it is just a much more intense experience.
Yeah, and when you're drinking, like, more complex wines, when you chew it, like, it, like, really brings out all these crazy flavors that, like, you may not have really picked up on in the beginning.
What about inhaling air through the wine while it's in your mouth?
Trilling. That's called trilling. And I prefer chewing over trilling, but it does kind of the same thing. I prefer chewing over trilling because it's not such a weird, annoying sound at the dinner table when you're with people that are not that into wine. I'm just like, I don't want to gross everybody out right now. Like, that's gross. Like it's just so disgusting. But it brings air into the mouth and kind of allows more of like the, you know, kind of just aerates the wine and releases a few more of the aromas and kind of softens things, maybe some tannins or the acidity, either way. But yeah, I personally am more of a chewer. Just my personal.
Should we move on to the red?
Yeah, I think, Melissa, you're not going to be a fan of this.
I'm open to it.
This looks very dark to me.
It is very dark. Like you can
It looks
barely,
almost opaque.
Yeah.
I'm thinking blood.
Mm, yeah. Notes of blood.
Notes of blood, definitely.
Which is scary because back in, like, I think it was, like, the 50s, the Italians, they got caught, like, putting ox blood in their wines because they were, like, it wasn't real wine. It was just, like, all this crazy stuff. And that's why this whole thing with chemicals is not new. People have been doing it forever.
It has a smell that I've noticed in a lot of wines that my sophisticated palate calls basement.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like I know exactly.
I didn't like grow up with a basement, so I can't. Growing up in California, I haven't been in very many basements, but I totally get. Mm. To me, this is like mothball-y alcohol with some just like berries that have been in the hot garbage.
Grandpa's house.
You call it grandpa's house?
Yeah,
grandpa's
a basement full of garbage.
Grandpa's yeah. Well, grandpa had a basement full of garbage.
Yeah, it definitely smells like garbage.
Well, I can't wait to drink this.
I know. Right. Well, see, but this is probably why you don't like red wine.
I don't think all wine, red wine smells like garbage. Just hold on.
Oh, man. It's like, it's definitely been oaked. And I'm going to chew it for the sake of science.
I think I'm going to not chew it.
I'm not chewing that one.
I'll let you chew it.
Oh.
I wish we could have taken a picture of your face right now. It was amazing.
Yeah.
So we brought three disgusting wines for Marissa Ross to drink today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're going to give you an occasion. You give us the wine we should bring. Okay. Some of these are from your book. Some of them we've added. So we just want your first response to each. This is rapid fire. Are you ready?
Yeah. Yes, I am. After I finish that great red, I'm ready to go.
Okay. Wine for when you've had a long day or a long week or a long month or a long life.
A big, warm, fuzzy red, not like the one we just had, but like something that's a little bit more, I like Zinfandels for that. Not the super high alcohol ones, like pick one that's more around like 13%, a Zinfandel, or also a French Malbec, I think is nice. The French Malbecs are, it's a cooler region, so they just have a lot less jam built into them. But you always, when you're having a long day, a long life, I personally want something warm and fuzzy. Like I want something that feels like a sweater is wrapped up inside of me.
For pre-gaming.
Vino Verde, as I said. Like, you know, it's the best. It's slightly effervescent. Okay. It's got it all, and you get to feel good about yourself and not get too drunk.
For celebrating.
For celebrating. Definitely champagne or any sort of sparkling wine. Treat yourself. You can also get great champagnes now for a much lower price point, especially in the natural kind of vibe. And, you know, you can spend like $50, which is still a lot, but like for champagne, you know, for celebrating, like that's not bad at all. And if you can't do that, definitely get yourself a cava. Cava is the Spanish sparkling wine that's made in the exact same method as champagne at a fraction of the cost. You can get a great bottle of cava for under $15.
For when you just got your heart broken.
I personally would choose a nice Beaujolais. That's my vibe. The Gamay, it's a wine that you can drink very readily, just go for it, and you can just kind of hang out with it and watch Sex and the City or whatever, or Seinfeld or whatever it is you do with your time when you're sad. Although don't drink too much when you're sad, because that's not a good coping mechanism. I gotta say that. So yeah, Gamay always.
For when you just woke up, walked into the kitchen, and saw a giant cockroach on your green market tomatoes.
Is this actually happened to you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I stepped on a cockroach with my bare feet once, and I almost killed. I was like, I reached for a knife. I was like, oh my God, I have to die now. This is the most disgusting thing ever.
And then you reached for
you got to reach for whatever bottle of wine that you did not finish from the night before. It does not even matter if it was corked. Just drink the damn wine, because cockroaches are so fucking disgusting. They're life ruining.
For when you're not exactly sad, but there is definitely this giant hole inside that cannot possibly be filled.
That's when I say drink the wine you love the most, even maybe something that you've been saving for something, you know, like when you're just like, I want to feel good about myself and like I'm just really bummed out, open that bottle that you've been saving and enjoy it yourself. Because a lot of times when there's a bottle that you've been saving for a quote unquote special occasion, you don't really actually get to enjoy it because you're with a bunch of people or you're eating dinner or it's a celebration and there's just so much going on. Open that bottle, enjoy it yourself, and feel better.
For an intimate dinner party.
Depends on what you're serving, but my first go-to is I love Montepulciano, the Italian red wine, or Sangiovese is also great too. I just think Italian wines really kind of encompass this very warm, fuzzy, like, let's be in, you know, like, let's hug each other and like, we just love each other, we're eating dinner together. Or if you want to do white wine, you could do, as I said before, like Trebbiano is a great Italian white wine that I love.
For a big dinner party with mostly randos.
I don't know what I said in the book, but I think I would say now like Grüner Veltliner, because it's pretty food friendly. You can buy it in liter size, so you can like feed a lot of people with it. And then you don't have to, and they're not too expensive, so you don't have to feel bad about it. And because when you're with randos, you're like, oh man, I don't want to bring something I love and then like have all these randos like take it all and you only get like a glass and then you're bummed. Like that sucks.
What about when you've been invited over to meet the parents of your partner for the first time?
You're going to want to probably bring something more traditional. So, I mean, unless they're like real progressive, like if they're like, you know, they're like really into NPR and like, and they're very exploratory and, you know, they've talked about LSD in the past or something, then like, sure, maybe bring them an orange wine. But generally with parents, you want to bring something that's a little bit more classic and recognizable. So you want to do like a Bordeaux or a Burgundy or like a classic California wine. And then they're like, oh, like this is impressive. Yeah.
And for when you're hungover, but still want to drink.
Yeah, hair of the dog. It happens. I say you got to do something cold, something sparkling. You almost want to just do a shitty beer almost at that point. But I would say that's a good time, again, for cava or prosecco, something like that, that you can just like pop and because you don't have to feel bad about it. Because then you're like, oh, it's just like brunch. It's fine. It's just brunch on a Wednesday. Who cares?
We'll be right back.
time for our upgrade of the week. Every week, we discuss that one tiny thing that's made a huge difference in our lives. Melissa, what's your upgrade this week?
So I've been following along with a life hacker series, the Lucid Dreaming Workshop, written by Patrick Allen. It's been a weekly workshop that he's been conducting on Lifehacker. You can find it on lifehacker.com. And one of the things that he advised in attempting to lucid dream is to try to remember your dreams and write down your dreams. So something I've been doing this week is writing down my dreams. And in order to keep them with me so that I can wake up enough to have the wherewithal to go write them down, I've been saying them out loud. So I woke up this morning and said my dream out loud, and somehow saying it and hearing it helped me to sort of capture it so that I could then go to my notebook and write down the dream. And I have this sort of catalog of my unconscious from the week, which is pretty nice.
I love that.
Yeah. Lucid Dream Workshop, lifehacker.com.
What's your upgrade this week?
So because of my job, when I go out to eat, like in New York City, it's generally like, oh my gosh, hey, like, and I like kind of know the chef or like whatever. And I end up being out until God knows what hour drinking so much wine, because if I just order a bottle of wine, like that's, I'm being like conservative. But people are like, well, you got to try this and you got to try this. You got to do that. So I have to find a reason to go back to my hotel room to like save myself from myself. Because I don't say no. Like if I'm in like with a chef and he's like so excited about something or like a passionate sommelier, like I want to be just as passionate with them. So I have to trick myself. I was like, you have to be like on this week. So I brought all of my face masks with me to New York, like every single like face skin product I own, because I'm very into like face masks and relaxing and like being in the tub, which I don't get to do that often in California because we've been in a drought. So I was like, all right, you're going to bring all your skin products and you'll go back to the room and take a bath and like and do your face mask instead of going out. Mm. And it saved me from myself and like from like not from being a mess. And it's like tricking yourself into like not loving staying out drinking wine.
But it's also such a nice way. It's like you're treating yourself instead of being
exactly.
punitive.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing. It's like I'm tricking myself. I'm like, ooh, I really got to go back because I bought myself a new Aesop mask and I really need to try that out. Nice. Like, because if you just say you can't, that's no fun.
Yeah.
Right. Then you feel like you're denying yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially with wine, something I love so much. So that's my life hack. Trick yourself into going home early.
Nice.
Give yourself a treat.
Yeah.
Alice, what's your upgrade?
Well, my upgrade is not small. It is that I quit sugar.
Whoa.
Yeah. Clearly not like all sugars, because I just drank some wine. Yeah. So I'm not going crazy about it. But for the past week, I have not had any desserts of any kind, which is a huge thing for me because I was having desserts after every meal, including breakfast.
So you treat yourself a lot, actually.
Post-breakfast treats was kind of a big thing with me. So, I got into such a habit of having sugar after almost every meal that I was just consuming way too much. Wow. And I was having headaches and I just wasn't feeling great. And I thought, you know, let me try to do this. And it's actually been strangely easy. And I think the reason is because I've done a couple of times the Whole 30. Which is like, I don't know if you guys know what the Whole 30 is, but it's like really intense. It's no grains, no sugar, no alcohol, no dairy, very limited fruits. So compared to that, it's just like no sugar. I'm just eating more cheese, basically. Like I'm just sort of, you know, treating myself in other ways.
I just love eating cheese. I want cheese with everything.
Cheese is the best. Yeah. So, you know, I feel like if I can have that, I'm fine. I've really noticed a difference just in the past week.
And how you feel?
Yeah, I feel better. I feel good.
Excellent.
So, you know, we'll see if I can keep this up. Forever.
Congratulations to you. That's a huge, that seems like a really big life change. That's awesome.
It's kind of a big upgrade. Yeah.
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 But that's good.
Thank you so much for being here, Marissa.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a real blast.
And that's our show. Come find us on Twitter. You can find me at Melissa Kirsch. You can find Alice Bradley at FinSlippy. You can find Marissa Ross at Marissa A. Ross. And of course, you can find Lifehacker at Lifehacker. The Upgrade is produced by Levi Sharp, who can also be found on Twitter at Levi Sharp with an E. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi. Brad Fisher mixed the episode.
We want to hear from you. Email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com. Or go old school and leave us a voice message at 347 687-8109. And you can always find us on Panoply, NPR One, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Follow Lifehacker on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.